often intense security measures in place at U.S. government installations like Area 51 in Nevada. She says various U.S. agencies tend to hide behind the notion of national security to keep documents related to ufology classified, and she further believes such tactics stifle the progress of any serious UFO research. What do you believe? We'd like your questions and comments on UFOs and government secrecy. Our phone numbers 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or 1-800-222-WILL. Susan Wright is the author of Destination Mars. She's also written four Star Trek novels. Her work has appeared in Cosmopolitan and Red Book magazines. Susan Wright, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you with us. First of all, if you could clarify what is meant by a UFO. The term doesn't, I assume, just include aliens.
Well, it's unidentified flying object. And UFO is used in the beginning, even flying saucer, the term flying saucer was used in the beginning just to indicate something that was unknown. There was an object in the sky. It was not a plane. It was not something identifiable. And so people started calling them flying saucers or UFOs. And I would say that still today we don't know what these objects are that people are seeing in the sky.
Now, what is, and I'm not sure if I've got this pronounced right, ufology or ufology? I've heard it different ways.
Right. I call it ufology. Because it's UFOs. So.
Right. What is it, and how does one become a ufologist?
Well, you can become a ufologist at home by just logging onto the Internet, apparently, today. There is a lot of information that's available on the Internet, including how to research the National Archives for declassified material. It includes how to investigate a sighting and how to investigate an encounter. That's the good thing about the Internet, you know, getting out information on, you know, not quite sanctioned topics. It's really opened up the field. But there have been serious ufologists going back to the 1950s, and the organizations that started back then, NICAP and APRO, which were acronyms for these groups that are now, you know, like MUFON, which is Mutual UFO Network, and the Computer UFO Network, and the computer, and the Fund for UFO Research. So when you started to investigate UFOs, you run into all of these acronyms. But basically, what it is the researching of exactly what is happening, what people are seeing, and trying to gather enough information to start seeing patterns.
Now, I'm sure that there are folks out there that are saying, well, you know, come on. I mean, these are just, you know, folks with nothing better to do with their time. But there are some folks that are quite serious about trying to investigate any unusual or unknown phenomenon.
Absolutely. And this includes NASA scientists. There are two NASA scientists in particular who have done quite a bit of UFO research for decades. One was Paul Hill. He created aircraft canopies, so he talked to pilots to see what sort of reflections were made by the curve of the glass. And in talking to these pilots to work out this very technological engineering problem, he started hearing about UFO sightings from these pilots. And as he put it in his book, which he published some 20 years after he stopped working for NASA, and it was just recently that he published this book, he said he was the unofficial clearinghouse for UFO sightings, and he actually began to experiment with craft that would perform the same sort of maneuvers that these pilots repeatedly reported seeing, the tilt to maneuver. Say if you take a disc and it tilts upward and it moves forward, it tilts backward to stop. And he actually got government grants to start working on flying platforms and things that would try to duplicate these maneuvers. Another NASA scientist is Gerald Haynes, and he developed AirCat, which has cataloged over 100,000 pilot sightings. And these are really valuable because pilots are up in the air, and it's much easier to judge the distance of something and how fast something is going because you can look at it against the ground, against the earth. So there are scientists that are gathering this information, and they are seeing patterns, and they're trying to talk about this. But it's very difficult because a scientist can ruin his reputation by becoming involved in ufology.
I'm going to want to take some phone calls, but first, if we could take some time to go through the history of UFOs. And we really have to go back a long way, I guess, because really UFOs didn't just start appearing when War of the Worlds was broadcast.
No, although there has been waves, peaks and waves throughout history. But there has been reported sightings in the sky. There's been reported contacts with creatures that are not like humans. And this goes throughout folklore. It's a part of our human history. I have in my book a picture of from Basel, Switzerland, of globes in the sky in 1500. They reported seeing all these globes in the sky, and they created actually this little woodcut pamphlet that showed these globes hovering in the sky for 24 hours, and that's part of our history. This is something that was seen. People don't understand what it was, and it's certainly no different than what's happening today over Phoenix, Arizona, where people see these globes, these lighted globes in the sky, and they can't explain it.
And there have been certainly, getting even past some of the ancient cultures, we could get to more recent times. When I say that, the 1600s, the 1700s, there are several writers who probably have impacted any interest in the UFO within our culture. Maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the early writings on the subject, folks like Johannes Kepler and John Wilkins.
Definitely. I mean, I actually go even back to things like St. Anthony, the Egyptian founder of the Christian monasticism.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed he met somebody in the a desert, a creature in the desert. Carl Jung pointed out that UFO phenomena is a mythology. Carl Jung wrote about UFOs in 1959, flying saucers, about what people were seeing in the sky. The Renaissance, people began, I think partly because people were discovering that that they could challenge religious authority. People like astronomer Johannes Kepler, he wrote, they started writing fiction about contact with alien beings. Swiss Gulliver Travel, I mean, that was this, he basically represented what a mothership is to us today, this hovering city of Laputa, and how wrapped up that was in with science. You also had things like an engraving from 1709 in which real scientists, I mean, the alchemists of the time, were trying to figure out how materials were able to affect other materials, like magnetism. And so they were working on how to do an airship based on magnetic power as far back as then. Even the Archbishop of Lyons wrote in a 9th century Latin manuscript that that three strange beings had fallen from a ship in the sky. And they believe this is where the term came from, Magnonia, where ships come from the clouds in the sky. So, I mean, you could hit on all of these people. This is just, it's rife. And I was very shocked because I had a vague interest in UFOs, but I had no idea that there was such a historical presence in our culture, the UFOs.
We have a person waiting on the line. Let's take this call from line 4, caller in Chicago. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, good afternoon to you. I'd like to make a sort of medium-length comment on the way to a question. I had the good fortune to, I forget Heinecke's classification, but I think I had a close encounter of the first kind. I had a very near sighting a long time ago. And that got me very interested. It was quite a something to see, and seemed to contradict in many ways some of my assumptions about the physical universe. Anyway, later on at University of Chicago, I ran into a guy who had been with Blue Book a long time, the Air Force secret classified investigation of these things. And I also was very close to Heinecke, who of course ran the private, tried to coordinate the private collection of data regarding these things. Heinecke came to the conclusion before he died that at least some of these objects or sightings or whatever you might want to call them are in no wise and in no sense, no ordinary sense, extraterrestrial. So that the confusion of UFOs, which is a nice open-ended kind of term, with the idea of extraterrestrial objects in his mind was at least sometimes a mistake, because really the laws of physics do not hold up in amazing numbers of sightings, and sightings also which are cross-correlated. I mean, people who have no way of getting information from other people report identical phenomena with every detail straight that have no no explanation within any physical observation. So he came to the conclusion, Heinecke, that these things, some of them at least, were coming from a parallel space where that somehow interfaces or interacts with our space-time so-called continuum here. And the question is simply, you were talking about the how obscure all these things, how difficult it is to come to simple conclusions about these things because of the governmental security apparatus. I was curious if you happen to know whether Heinecke's progress had been inhibited, and if so, what way, whether he did not, in fact, you know, enjoy the opportunity to collect data pretty freely and independently, and how government, I mean, I can see obviously they had data that he couldn't get at, but I don't know, was there any interference there, active interference, or that's my question.
All right. Well, we thank you for the question. Susan, do you know anything about that specific case?
Basically, I do know that he said at the end of his term that they had never really had a valid scientific discussion on the matter. He felt that a lot of what was happening, particularly in Blue Book, was PR-oriented and containment-oriented. And I'm, you know, only he could say if he was kept from information, but I do know he was frustrated with the lack of a scientific investigation of the information that was being made available to them. It seemed, particularly at the end in Blue Book, that a lot of what was being done was just writing off, trying to explain these things to get them out of the way. There's a definite difference in it from the beginning to the end in how many sightings were marked as unknown. In the later times, any explanation, sometimes two or three explanations, were used to try to explain why a sighting was something like the planet Venus or a confusion or something like that. So I think that from the beginning, it's definitely true that government dealings with UFOs has been a defensive posture rather than offensive. They've been worried about what the public is going to think of this, particularly in terms of panic. You know, are people going to panic and start distrusting the government, start distrusting authority and running in all directions? And so in some ways, from that moment on, from Project Blue Book, which certainly started out as a viable way to deal with the problem, turned into containment. The government even believes, I mean, still to today, that there was a 1953 meeting of minds on this whole thing, and they decided it would be dangerous to the public public morale to keep on telling people that we don't know what these objects are. And, you know, this is the height of the Cold War. So ever after, we're still suffering under Cold War secrecy, Cold War propaganda from our government to try to calm us down and make us feel better about this situation, when what we really should be doing is moving on and investigating it in a serious scientific way and not expect results in the first year, in the first 10 years.
Now, Project Blue Book that you mentioned, it was just one report on how the government investigated UFOs. Maybe you could take a moment to talk about not just what prompted that, but also what prompted additional reports like the Robertson Panel, the Condon Committee. What were these? What prompted them? And what were their findings in each case?
Right. Okay. The Robertson Panel was the 1953 panel, and they were trying to decide what to do about this problem of UFOs and not knowing exactly what was happening.
When you say the problem of UFOs, you mean the fact that there had been a significant number of sightings, what you refer to as the UFO wave of 1947.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Exactly. And it was the alleged threat of, like, clogging the channels of communication by irrelevant reports.
Mm-hmm.
They were worried about people being obsessed by UFOs when there might be incoming missiles. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
When we really had a legitimate fear that, America was going to be bombed. So the Robinson panel took only 12 hours to take one brief look at everything that had been gathered to that point by Blue Book, in particular the Air Force investigations. And after 12 hours, they basically just said, we believe that you need to make a program designed to reassure the public of the total lack of evidence of it, of danger behind this phenomenon. Basically, that's what they were focusing on, is telling us that everything will be okay. This is not a problem. So then after that, the Brookings Institute report in 1960 was NASA did that. And NASA's Committee on Beings in Space investigated this because they figured they might find something on some planet, an alien artifact. And this was a secret National Security Agency document. And they basically said that they're the ones that came up with the idea that in the past, a technologically superior people possessed the more aggressive culture, and they normally take over the less developed, which would be us, culturally, people. So they said that there would be worry that if we run into alien beings, we would be subsumed into their culture. And so they said, based on this, we need to tell the uninitiated, we need to tell the public that nothing's happening, because we don't want them to be worried about this, and we want to be able to control it if something does happen. The government wants to be able to take control of this situation. Well, then on the back, so this is the Condon Report, and the Condon Report came about after Hynek actually made a comment about a UFO that was seen by something like 67 girls in a girls' school. And some of the people that were taking care of them, they saw these UFOs, and Hynek said, "Oh no, that's just marsh gas or something like that, or maybe that's partly what it was caused by." And this just really set off a public condemnation of Blue Book and what they were doing. So, the Condon Committee was basically, in part, set up by the CIA, and again, it was just a publicity ploy as a memo that got accidentally released. To the press said the trick would be to describe the project so that to the public it would appear totally objective, but to the scientific community would present the image of people who don't believe that this is anything and have zero expectation that anything would come out of it. So basically would placate the scientists, placate the public, and then the government could continue researching this. And then after that, we didn't really hear too much. So one must assume, since all these private recommendations said the government should keep on investigating UFOs but not tell the public what is happening, that this is indeed what started happening. Somewhere, the government investigations went underground, perhaps into NASA, which would be the natural place for it to go, which is perhaps why there's so many NASA scientists who are now talking about their involvement in UFO research and in gathering UFO reports.
Could you give some examples of what ufologists consider to be significant or important UFO sightings that occurred through, say, the 40s, 50s, and 60s? Were there some major ones that that really prompted all of this discussion?
Well, of course, the 1947 one was Kenneth Arnold saw what he described. Actually, he didn't describe it, but a reporter described it as a flying saucer skipping across the sky, and he saw six or seven of these in Washington. And in 1947, of course, come the Roswell, the rumors of the Roswell crash, where the debris was apparently found and brought to the government. And there's two different explanations. Was it a high altitude listening device for nuclear explosions, the Mogul Project, as the government claims, or was it a UFO that had crashed and possessed miraculous material? Roswell is undoubtedly the most famous, I would say, UFO sighting, and there's been more and more witnesses that have come out, and contradictions and key witnesses changing their minds, and it's a very problematic thing. I think any time you look at one sighting, particularly one that's so old, there was also major waves that took place, particularly in America, There was the Washington wave of 1952 when UFOs were seen directly over the nation's capital and fighter jets were scrambled to intercept these objects that were seen on radar screens. And they never did figure out what these were, these objects were. They moved far too fast for the technology of the time, and they never did determine what it was. They did tell the public that it was a weather phenomenon, an inversion, and some sort of reflection off of clouds. But the people who actually had been in the radar rooms at the time were saying, no, this it couldn't possibly have been that. It just didn't react the same way. And then it's a little bit more difficult to follow the waves after the open and official Blue Book project stopped because people didn't know where to go with their sightings. But there seems to be, when you look at Freedom of Information Act documents that have been released, that means classified documents that have been released because their time of classification is up. And these describe a wave that happened in 1975, particularly over nuclear installations. And the government, again, has no idea why unidentified objects appeared and hovered over nuclear installations. There was also, that was the time when cattle mutilations became quite big. And then I would say in the 90s, we've had a real surge in sightings. And we've had a surge in public response from public officials to sightings. So perhaps the tide is turning in the sense that people are becoming more and more curious about this as they become more open about speaking about it. It's not such just a crazy thing.
We're talking with Susan Wright. She's author of UFO Headquarters, Investigations on Current Extraterrestrial Activity. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And we welcome your questions and comments. The phone number to call, 333-9455. That's in Champaign-Urbana, or from anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And, Susan, something we haven't talked about yet, that certainly we should since you began your book with it, is Area 51.
Yes.
Tell us, what is Area 51? Where is it? What goes on there? And maybe if you could explain your experience with the security there.
Okay. Area 51 is a government base that is was established in Nevada. It is between the Nevada test site, which was the nuclear proving ground, the major nuclear proving ground for the U.S. government, and between the Nellis Air Force Base, which is a gunnery range where the planes fly over and bomb the ground to see how accurate they are. Well, in there is a small square of land that's been designated, we assume, Area 51. That's certainly the name that we've given it. This base is run by we don't know who. We don't know if it's the Air Force. We don't know if it's NASA. But we do know that it produces Black Project aircraft. Black Project aircraft are research and development aircraft like the U-2 stealth airplane. These projects are funded through Congress, but Congress doesn't know what they're funding. Only four members of Congress have the clearance to know what exactly they're funding. All they know is this has to do with national security, and they say, I and pass billions of dollars into this unknown arm of the government. All these different agencies have Black Projects, so they all develop our research and development craft, and many of them test them out at Area 51. Now, the reason we know this is from satellite pictures, particularly Russian satellite pictures, which took images of the desert as they flew over, and you can't hide these enormous runways. They're the longest runways in the world, and they stretch across a dry lake called Groom Lake out there in the desert. And you can see the complex, the hangars where they keep the aircraft. So we know that there's something a lot happening out here. What we don't know is who is running it and who is running the security force. People have gone out to Area 51, tried to get close to Area 51. There used to be a little rise that you could stand on, and you could actually see some of the buildings. Through government land acquisitions, which is basically they said, ooh, we've got to take this chunk of land because it's a danger to national security, again, you can't see it anymore. You can't get near it. The closest you can get is down a long dirt road in a little, ravine. There's just signs that say, trespassers, you can't, will be arrested. And at one point it actually said, trespassers will be killed. On these signs, and they finally just changed it the second time I went back to make it a little bit, I think, more not so shocking. Because when you're out there, you drive up, and as we drove up, we were met. A white Jeep Cherokee met us in the dirt road, pulled up right on the other side of the signs, and the windows are all tinted, so you can't see in. And we just waited there for a bit. We got out. We started to walk along the border. You can see the border because there's signs and there's sensors, electronic sensors. There's cameras sitting up on the hills following your every movement. And there's men who wear sensitive areas. I actually toured the Nevada test site. And I've never seen security like this before in my life. So when I started looking at the radio frequencies that they were using, since you couldn't hear exactly what they're saying, well, radio frequencies are like a thumbprint. They are licensed to certain agencies. And four out of the five radio frequencies were licensed to FEMA. And that's the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And that's when I really started getting interested, because what is FEMA doing out at Area 51? Those are the people that take care of, like, hurricanes, like the hurricane that just hit, right? They go in there and clean things up. Well, that's when I found out that 90% of what FEMA does is actually is to protect the government in case of natural disaster, in case of nuclear disaster. They build massive underground complexes that they can, they have like 96 of them around Washington that they can just move the government into. And people don't know about this because it's all secret. Much of their money just goes into secret budgets and to protect things like Area 51.
Now, forgive me, this is sort of playing devil's advocate here, but
sure.
I'm sure that there are listeners right now who are saying, well, didn't I see this in the X-Files movie?
It's definitely true. I mean, when I started investigating this, one could still say I'm a skeptic, because I don't believe that belief has any place in this discussion. So all I know is what I've been able to find out. What I've been able to find out is there are hundreds of thousands of people that see things in the sky, see things near the ground, that behave in consistent ways. I never found anything about extraterrestrials. I never found concrete proof on abductions or anything like that. So there's a big leap to the X-Files. What I found is that something's happening. Now, this could be as simple as Earthlights, geophysical phenomenon. It could be they just discovered jets and sprites in the upper atmosphere, which they had no idea existed, and these are powerful, unusual phenomena that are happening. Then again, it could be, as some people claim, it's extraterrestrial. But all I know is that the UFO phenomenon has been used by the government. The CIA actually has admitted using UFO sightings to cover up stealth flights, stealth test flights. They didn't want anybody to know that they were flying the U-2 bomber out of Area 51. And so if anybody saw it and people said, oh, I saw a UFO because it was moving so fast, it was making strange maneuvers, they encouraged that.
Well, I think the question is, if they're covering up, you know, technologically advanced weaponry, advanced stealth technology, something like that, why should we be concerned about significant security? Don't we want that? Or is there any danger to allowing that to continue?
I think there's a danger lies in the secrecy. I think, yes, if what they're doing out there is, you know, developing these very sensitive weapons that they do not want terrorists, for example, to get hold of, absolutely, that calls for extreme secrecy. But why is it being kept so secret from the American public exactly who is out there and what they're doing? There's something like 250,000 new secrets made in 1996, and auxiliary secrets. And these secrets are supposedly so sensitive that if any of them get out, it could endanger the national security of our country. And that's what I think is a problem. I don't think that we're on such shaky ground. I think that America is a democracy and that its citizens can know more about what's happening, because in this way we can control the abuses of our government. And we have to admit, bureaucracy creates abuses. Contractors, if we don't understand who's getting these contracts and how they're fulfilling these contracts, I mean, this is why $2 billion is spent on a stealth bomber. Is that necessary? We don't know. We don't know because there's so much secrecy around this. So I think that actually government secrecy does harm America in worse ways than telling people FEMA's out there protecting Area 51. That's a cut and dried thing. Why not just tell us? It's our money that's going to pay for all this stuff, and it's certainly not going to endanger the national security.
Let's take another phone call. We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi. I guess I consider myself a skeptic, but certainly interested in the subject. I mean, I think it's a fascinating part of our culture right now with the popularity of the X-Files and such. But the one thing when you were talking about Area 51, I guess the question is that I have is, where do we make the leap from a super secret military base to that they're housing UFOs there? Because, I mean, it seems like the security protocols that you mentioned would be in keeping with something where they're developing maybe very secret, very dangerous technology. But why does it follow that there are flying saucers there?
Basically what happened was people have reported seeing UFOs out there. This goes from people who are quite qualified, like Mark Farmer, who was a pilot and a photojournalist for the U.S. Coast Guard. He actually saw a multicolored object out there that was behaving in strange ways. This could be something as simple as an automated aerial platform. And he keeps an open mind. He's not willing to ascribe that that's aliens in a vessel. But there's also hundreds of sightings that have happened out there where people are absolutely positive that this is a flying saucer. People believe that they've been abducted. I talked to one person who said in 1993 he and his wife were abducted by gray aliens by a leader who called himself Quelar and went off on this whole story. And he was a part of, like, the Mutual UFO Network in Arizona. So this is where we get a lot of these stories from, is the folklore has just built up around Area 51. There's been Bob Lazar said he actually was hired by the government to help back engineer UFOs out at Area 51. So that's what happens when there's so much secrecy, and particularly government secrecy surrounding UFOs and then government secrecy surrounding the research and development projects. People start to make the link and think, okay, what they've done is they've got the saucer that crashed out at Roswell. They took it to Area 51. They're trying to figure out how it's working. And these things that we are seeing are government tests of extraterrestrial technology. It's a leap. I think it's definitely. When I tried to check out Bob Lazar's background, it just doesn't pan out. He said he has degrees that he doesn't have. And often that's what happens when you try to check on these stories. It's just a first-person testimonial, and there's just no way to confirm it.
I guess the other thing, too, of course, I mean, when you talk about seeing UFOs, I mean, really, a UFO, by definition, just means something that flies that you can't identify.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it follows that it could just simply be, you know, some kind of experimental government craft that nobody can identify because they just don't know.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they are doing miraculous things with aircraft. They have aircraft that can take off, you know, vertically, that can hover,
mm-hmm.
that can stay in the air for weeks because they can be refueled in the air. The laser sightings that they have for their weapons, it's made them extremely efficient. They can go so fast and so far, they can circle the globe. It is remarkable. And again, they are doing a lot of work with remote-controlled aircraft, particularly when it comes to surveillance and like civil unrest and terrorism, anti-terrorism. So they are developing amazing things, and quite likely what people are seeing, particularly out at Area 51, is testing of these objects.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for that phone call. And we still have a few minutes left, time for some more calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We're talking with Susan Wright. She's author of the book UFO Headquarters, Investigations on Current Extraterrestrial Activity. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. You know, there are skeptics out there who would say, you know, this is just much ado about nothing. There's no grand conspiracy. There are no top secret programs. Don't waste my time. You know, how would you respond to that? And are you concerned that some would say, well, you know, why should I believe anyone who writes science fiction?
Oh, no, that doesn't bother me at all. Basically, I had the same opinion. I'd never seen a UFO. I never believed in UFOs or believed in actually even the abduction theories. What I did, though, is I was curious about it, and I think a lot of us are curious about this, because if it is a much ado about nothing, it certainly is much ado. And where is this all coming from? So I approached it as sort of a sociological interest. And when I picked up books, I kept reading about individual cases and what one person believed and all of these ideas that were not backed up by solid information. So what I wanted to do in this book was to basically survey the whole phenomenon, try to gather the most reliable information, the most reliable researchers, particularly scientists. People had been doing this for decades. Basically, the people who had a moderate view. I also wanted to check out, you know, government documents, and I wanted to check out research that had been done on how sightings were gathered and things like that. So I just basically took an overall view, gathered the most reliable information, and I was rather surprised by what I found, which is there are people are seeing these, and most of the people that are extremely reliable witnesses are people like you and me, our parents, our brothers and sisters, go out in their backyard and they see something, and it's shocking to them, like the first caller that we had, because these objects do things that we don't expect to see. It can have a profound impact on people. I'm not willing to say what exactly they're seeing, but all of my research definitely tells me that this phenomenon is happening. People are seeing strange lights in the sky. And reputable scientists affirm we are seeing strange lights in the sky. And I think that that's a wonderful mystery that should be investigated. I think it could tell us a lot about either our planet, if our planet's creating this, or beyond our planet. Whatever it is, I think it's a mystery that we shouldn't just let sit because we think it's silly that it's little green men. I think we should find out exactly what is happening.
Let's take another call. Caller on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon.
I'm enjoying this quite a bit.
Okay.
I did want to offer this knowledge. I have no other comment to make except that as an instructor, when Chanute was still open, I got disturbed by the number of retrainees I was having from the security police at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. And when I queried them in counseling session, they just said that there was so much happening out on the missile ranges. Now, the missile ranges were a farmhouse where the double garage would go down into the actual control center of missiles going out towards Russia. And they said they couldn't stand the uncertainty of what they were going to see. That is, they couldn't put it together logically so that there was a regular train of people who are being retrained from that. But later, I got to Malmstrom on my own. I was a civilian working for the Air Force. And I saw the number of morning reports of last night's activities. The base engineer was got to be a friend of mine, and he showed me what the security police out on these missile ranges were just finally had given up and put down the Polish Air Force as their indice of the number of activities of the night before. I have no other comment than that. It just seems to point towards your level-headed outlook at this thing.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Maelstrom. Was that in the mid-70s?
Yes.
Yes, that was a wave that happened where the nuclear sites were being plagued by UFOs. They had no idea what these objects were. It was happening consistently. And I've seen the Freedom of Information Act documents that were released, and the government never was able to figure out what it was. And they spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it was. So that's actually one of the most believable cases to me.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it definitely is, in the sense that something was happening. The government really seriously investigated it, and they still don't know what happened.
And you and I have never met.
No.
Thanks
no, a lot. I think it's very interesting that you bring it up.
All right. Thank you very much for the phone call. We only have a minute or two left. Maybe you could tell folks about some of where they could find out more information about some more serious research that's taking place. What are some of the places, like maybe the National Institute of Discovery Science and other such organizations?
The National Institute of Discovery Science is up and running. They've definitely done some. They try to do serious like analysis of implants that people bring them, or of cattle mutilations, things of that sort. The one that I would absolutely recommend to anyone out there is the Fund for UFO Research. The Fund for UFO Research, you can actually find it on the net, or you can, I believe it's based out of New York, I'm not sure, but you can actually find it on the internet. They have gathered documents written by credible scientists, written by researchers, on from A to Z on this subject, and they offer them for a very small charge. And what they do with the money that they raise is they give it to other projects that are working to scientifically investigate this phenomenon. So I would recommend them for the beginning, because you can certainly find more solid information there than anything. I mean, the internet is very difficult. You really have to weed through some stuff when you start researching UFOs, because you can find everything out there on the internet. But start with a Fund for UFO Research. The organizations like Mutual UFO Network, they are they're trying very hard, and it depends on the organization that you're with. It depends on what area you're in. They often hold classes and seminars that are very informative as well. But that, again, is also almost more of a support and social group around people who enjoy researching this stuff. If you want to do really solid research, I would just start with the documents.
Susan, I'm afraid we are absolutely out of time, but I appreciate very much you taking the time with us this afternoon. That's Susan Wright. She's author of UFO Headquarters, Investigations on Current Extraterrestrial Activity. The book is published by St. Martin's Press.